This is Matt Osborne.
This is Pat King.
My name is Martin Armstrong.
This is Alex Craner.
This is Franco Terrazano, and you're listening to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the podcast, folks. Happy Monday. We got a cool one on tap for you today. But before we get there, let's talk about our sponsors of the show. First off, Canadians for Truth, nonprofit organization consisting of Canadians who believe in honesty, integrity, and principled leadership in government, as well as the Canadian Bill of Rights, Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and Rule of Just Laws. Of course, I'm talking about Joseph Borgo, Theo Fleury, and Jamie Soleil. They got a couple of shows coming up here. Mac Mora is in Calgary August 24th. That's a live show with Theo and Jamie, of course. Then Rodney Palmer is their one after that, September 20th in Calgary. So a couple of live shows coming up. You can buy tickets, for that at canadiansfortruth.ca. You can also see all their live their shows. You got Jamie, Unstoppable Truth. You got Theo Fleury and Joseph Borgo also with their shows. All you got to do is go to canadiansfortruth.ca. Tyson and Tracy Mitchell, Mitchco Environmental, they're looking for equipment operators. Farming experience is a bonus. They also look for laborers, seasonal or full-time. Just go to mitchcocorp.ca or give them a call, 780-214-4004. I was talking early on at this beginning of summer, you know, I hate to put the thought in there. But, you know, as we wind down on August, you know, at the start, they were looking for seasonal work through all summer where you can make upwards of, $20,000 plus, or maybe $20,000 plus plus. And I was like, whew, maybe. Let me just put the podcast on hiatus here for a couple months, folks, and away you go. Anyways, I joke about it, but you can earn some good money for a family-led business. All you got to do is go to mitchcocorp.ca, and you can find out more there. Clay Smiley's team over at Profit River, they got multiple different ways you can do this. You know, anywhere in Canada. They serve all of Canada. You can, of course, buy things right off on or rated online, not offline. Offline too, right? Come to the showroom here in Lloydminster. But of course, then if you're not, if you're not the avid outdoorsman or sportsman. Sportsman, outdoorsman, I don't know what the heck I'm trying to say here. All I'm trying to say is you can also purchase gift cards. Like, I can't even spit it out Monday, you know? Hey, Monday, how are you doing? Not that great. Come on, shit. Anyways, get it together here. You can purchase gift cards for, you know, maybe it's an anniversary, maybe it's a birthday, maybe it's the holidays, et cetera, et cetera. And then they ship Canada-wide, country-wide. So wherever you are, they can get it into you. They specialize in importing firearms to the United States. They're experts in their field. And with everything going on in today's world, you want some people who know what the heck they're talking about. Just go to ProfitRiver.com. They are the major retailer of firearms, optics, and accessories serving all of Canada. And finally, Patreon, folks. You're going to hear it at the end of mine and Biva's conversation. We've been carrying on some conversations, some bonus material that's exclusive to Patreon in the show notes. If you're so inclined, click on there. It's a way to support the podcast. And then I've been, me and Tuz have been every week adding a little bonus material from the Tuesday mashup. And then I've been getting a few different guests to give me a little bonus content for Patreon only. And Viva was so generous today to do that. So if you're interested in that, go to the link in the show notes, Patreon, sign up, and look forward to hearing your guys' thoughts or maybe some ideas you want to see there, etc. And, you know, that's up to you guys. Now, let's get on that tail of the tape brought to you by Hancock Petroleum. For the past 80 years, they've been an industry leader in bulk fuels, lubricants, methanol, and chemicals delivering to your farm, commercial, or oil field locations. For more information, visit them at hancockpetroleum.ca. He's a Canadian lawyer turned YouTube star. His channel has 568,000 subscribers with over 155 million views. I'm talking about David Freiheit, or maybe you know him as Viva Frey. So buckle up. Here we go.
This is Viva Frey. You're listening to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast. Today I'm joined by David Freiheit, or as probably everybody knows, you have Viva Frey. Either way, sir, thanks for giving me some time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You know, it's funny. I was saying to you before we started, like, you've been on a list. I even put it out at the start of 2023. I'm like, okay.
Nobody likes hearing they're on a list, but I know we're where this all on, is going.
Let's be clear. We're all on some list here in Canada at this point. But, you know, I put you on a list of like top 10 I would like to finally get to chatting to in 2023. And, you know, there's some high company to be there. And you're number three I've knocked off that list this year. And certainly there's some other Canadians that I would love to get to. I mean, I'll keep throwing it out to the universe. But Jordan Peterson at some point. Here in my home, the province I currently live in Alberta, he's a hometowner, so we hope to get there. But either way, I'm knocking one off today. I'm excited about it. But Viva, I don't know a whole heck a lot about you. You know, like I act like I do because I've watched, you know, it's this weird world where people listen to you and they're like, oh yeah, I know Viva. And I'm like, yeah, but what do you actually know about Viva?
And depending on where they know me from, they might think they know wildly different things. If people only knew me from Twitter, I seriously think they might they might have good cause to think that I'm the biggest asshole on the planet. So if anybody only knows me from Twitter, well, you'll get to know me a little bit more now. If anybody knows me from YouTube Rumble, from long format interviews, they'll know me in a different way. If anybody, you know, got to know me early with the car vlogs or the family stuff even earlier, then you probably know everything there is to know about me. Youngest of five kids, born and raised in Montreal. I weighed 10.5 pounds when I was, or 10 pounds, 6 ounces. So nobody accuses me of lying when I was born. So like the fifth kid virtually falls out. Four boys, one girl. Sorry, that might be TMI. Apparently my mother didn't even know she gave birth with me. It just happened. Born and raised in Montreal. I say a Jewish family by upbringing, but with varying degrees of religiousness. A few of us are much more religious than myself, for example. Born and raised in Montreal. Let's see. Hellion as a kid. You can't get kicked out of elementary school, but I bounced around three different high schools in 5 years. Settled down in Cégep. If people don't know what that is, it's the 2 years after high school before university. Studied McGill philosophy honors degree. Went on to study law at Université Laval in Quebec City. Went on to work for one of Canada's biggest law firms as a stagiaire right out of law school, young lawyer. Had a midlife crisis after the birth of my first kid, left the law firm, thought I was going to go study commercial photography, ended up starting my own solo practice because the calls came in faster than I could actually get rejected from commercial photography at Dawson College. Started my own solo practice, built that up into a boutique, then shut it all down. Give or take 2016, it took a few years to wind it down. Went full-time YouTube. Then the world went batshit crazy. COVID hit, I ended up doing what I'm doing now, which is working with Rumble in terms of service, content creation, exclusivity. Moved down to Florida because COVID was requiring me to do things with my kids that I was not prepared to do. And here we go. But I know there's a lot to break down there.
That was a lot. And I'm going to try and slow it down because one of the things I hope I do well is I genuinely am curious about, you know, like, obviously we can talk a lot about COVID. We certainly have on this show. You know, I don't have a lot of time for YouTube because in the middle of COVID, it pulled me from everything and I get the self-censorship and like the stuff you have to jump and dive and navigate through the YouTube world. I got a ton of time for Rumble and they've been getting better. I'm sure you can attest to that on a whole bunch of different levels. But, you know, I'll go back. I'm going to start with high school. What the heck was it about three high schools in that short? Were you the goon? Were you walking around or?
No, it was fun. So the funny thing is never violence against people and not violence against property if such a thing exists. But you know, I was a youngest of five kids, whether or not anyone wants to get Freudian and say I lacked attention from my parents. And so I was trying to get it somewhere else. I don't think I lacked attention from my parents. My mother was a stay-at-home mother or still is. I mean, she's alive. I won't say how old she is, but you know, we had a loving, normal family. My father worked a lot. And now as a father of three, I can understand why a father of five worked 7 days a week and, you know, almost probably found it easier to be at the office than to be at home with five screaming hellions. But for whatever the deep-rooted psychological reason, I was a problem-ish kid in elementary school, which materializes in different ways than it does in high school. That's like stupid things like, you know, dropping glass bottles down the center of stairwells.
A stairwell?
Like stupid things that you know, I now look at, I won't say I look at my kid, but I look at kids and say kids are idiots. They do stupid things. get into high school, the stupid things are no longer quite so funny. And so I got kicked out of one high school. It was a Jewish high school, grade 7, called Bialik. Got into a private school called Lower Canada College, LCC, where I was politely asked after 2 years to leave. I'd be happier elsewhere. They don't invite me back for any alumni events. And then I went to this place called St. George's High School, where I got into the arts, sort of toned down a little bit. And then, you know, just like, I won't say just like that, but at some point, things get boring, things get old, and young idiot boys mature a little bit. And then I graduated from St. George's High School, was into the arts, graphic arts, drawing, all sorts of stuff. Went to Dawson College, and then found, sort of like when you are interested in what you're studying, it becomes a lot easier to succeed at it compared to when you hate every single day of school.
And I say this truth.
I say this hoping my kid's not going to hear this, because one of my kids doesn't like school. I mean, and I know the pain all too well. I hated school. I hated the smell of it. I hated the sound of it. I hated walking in and hearing those lockers banging. I hated the ambiance. I hated the subordination that students had to have to teachers. I hated all of it. Then you get into a CEGEP, or like post-secondary, where you can pick your classes, study what you want. I was studying film, studying philosophy, studying creative arts. And I was on the dean's list
all of a sudden you're like, what is this? Do I enjoy going to school?
I look forward to going to school. I look forward to my classes. I look forward to my professors. And then, you know, I started succeeding academically. I made the dean's list at Dawson, then started studying philosophy at McGill, did an honors degree with a minor in Eastern European history, and studied law. But it's a weird thing. I mean, I don't know. I sort of say my childhood is the only normal thing that I can compare it to. But then, you know, when I talk to people and describe some of the stories of my childhood, they're like, in a different time, in a different country, you'd have ended up in jail a number of times. So, but for the grace of God, it was Canada. It was the 80s to the 90s, and things weren't then what they are today.
Well, it's interesting. I see a lot of similarities then, because I'm the youngest of 5. You know, I get teased by my older siblings that I'm the golden child and a whole bunch of different things, right? Because I was a little rebellious. Nothing quite to the extent of moving 3 different high schools or anything such as that. But I also know that going to college and stumbling upon history, and all of a sudden, you know, and I met my girlfriend, now wife, back then, and that helped straighten a few things out as well. Either way, as soon as I found what I wanted to do, I went from being, you know, maybe 70, mid-70s, high 70s average, maybe, to like, you know, A-plus student, or A-minus, I guess. You know, back then, I can't act like I was A-plus. I was A-minus, Viva. But either way, I was, you know, it's crazy what happens when all of a sudden you find it. And certainly, I'm curious about, you know, making the jump lawyer to where your YouTube, you know, like, to me, that's wild. But in fairness, I just made that jump, not lawyer, but I was working in the oil field. And I think everybody understands oil field money and certainly how well of a paying job that is here out west. And even if you're out east, if you make the move out west, you can understand the oil field. And made the move from oil field worker to full-time podcaster, which has been...
It's a blessing. It's like the Japanese concept of ikigai.
Ikigai,
like what you like, what you're good at, what the world needs, what you can make money doing. When those overlap, you found your purpose. And it's amazing because I compare it to law. First of all, and I've said this a number of times, it's like there was never one day later where I loved the practice of law more than the day before. So it was not a love affair. It was, I kept doing it. I said, I'll give myself 6 months. If I don't like it in 6 months, I'll stop. If I don't like it in 6 months, I'll stop. Then, you know, life ends up happening. If stage is called an internship. It's like after you graduate from the bar school, I have to make sure I remember the order, but you have to pass the bar and then do your internship and then get hired back by the law firm. I forget. Geez, Louise, do your stage before getting your bar. It doesn't matter. So I was, you know, you get a job out of law school, and I was one of the 1% law students that gets a job at a big firm. And it's not that a big firm is any better than a small firm. There's just different protocols. Some people say it's actually worse. You don't get to do real lawyer work, you know, for a couple of years because they train you, they groom you, they make sure you know what you're doing before you go out and represent the firm. You get a training for sure. So I get a stage right out of law school. It's like the biggest mark of success. Success in that, you know, you have a job and you don't have to worry about starting on your own or going to a small questionable boutique firm and getting questionable experience or guidance. But I hated it. I mean, it was tedious, mind-numbing work. And I said, okay, well, it'll get more interesting after my internship. And then I got hired back as a young lawyer. I was like, okay, it's not much more interesting yet. Six months. Then I got married when I was doing my internship. Then we had a kid. I was like, well, you can't really leave right when you have a kid. Except that's when I sort of hit the wall. I was like, I had my kid, took a couple of months parental leave, and then came back to work. And I was like, this is not a life. Leaving the house before the kid is awake, coming back after my kid is asleep. And I just hate pushing paper day in and day out. And so I said, that's it. It's like you're jumping from, at the time, it was a high 80s, $1,000 a year job. But this is in the year 2000. Holy cows, I can't remember my life. 2007, give or take. So it's a decent paying job. And then you leave the security. And I say, I'm going to go study commercial photography because I'd rather be poor and miserable than wealthy. And I'd rather be poor and happy than wealthy and miserable. And then, before I could even get rejected from commercial photography, people start calling saying, Dave, we need some work. What do you charge? And here, you go from where they would bill me out as a first year lawyer for a second, third year lawyer for like $250. I'm on my own. It's like, well, I can charge whatever the hell I want. I've got my overhead consists of nothing. So I can pick the files that I want and I can charge a reasonable amount that I think people should be able to afford as an attorney. And I thought, okay, well, this will make it more interesting. Being master of my practice, I can pick the files I want. I can run them the way I want. I don't have to take orders from anybody. It was more interesting for a short period of time, but then it just turned into the same tedious paper pushing. And the practice of law is like, I see, for anybody who's ever seen the inside of a courtroom, it's like a Vegas casino without the gambling, without the alcohol. So it's just a miserable, depressing, decrepit institution.
Pump full of oxygen.
Yeah, pump full and cold air. And and it's just the practice was tedious. You ended up pushing paper. You're not making any difference. You're stuck in a big broken machine, but the money's good. Well, that can only make someone happy for so long before they end up a 55-year-old miserable person with a heart that caves on them because of the last 20 years of miserable life that they've been living. And YouTube became something of an option. There was a bit of a transition, but at one point I said to my wife, I'm going to be miserable doing this. And at that time, I had sort of figured out video licensing, viral videos, and all this stuff. And one of the videos that I had just, put together consisted of me tying a plastic bag to an iPhone, attaching it to a rope and swinging it around in a circle where the bag created drag. And when you did that in slow motion, you sort of got like a gyroscopic video effect. And it looked like a 360 slow-mo camera. I made this video, sold it a few times. And then my wife says, Dave, if you can make money taping a plastic bag to an iPhone, we'll figure it out. So do what you have to do that's not going to result in you being a miserable person, when you're 50.
Sounds and like then, a special lady then, because, I'm sure you've got plenty of things to say there. The encouragement is got to be like, I don't know, not 90% of it, but it could have gone the other way. Like, Dave, you're not leaving your job. You're insane.
You idiot. We have a kid now. She's 6 months old. What the? My wife never, she's an Eastern Townships girl. Not to say like small town, different type of expectations. We started dating in 1999 when I was first year philosophy at McGill and she was in Sejep. And so she knew me when I was a hippie. I had hair longer than this back then, wearing tank top. She knew me when I was a hippie bum before becoming a lawyer. So it wasn't as though we started dating when I was wearing suits and had short hair.
That's what it was, though. When you became a lawyer and you had to get a fresh haircut, that's probably what really pissed you off.
Soul crushing. It was in law school. I started doing law school and I looked like this. And then, I realized I'm just not going to get taken seriously. So I might write the same thing as somebody else and I'll get judged differently because of my appearance. It's like, oh, I'll cut the hair. And it was like cutting the locks off of Samson spiritually, not physically or intellectually. And then I went down the straight and narrow and it was fun for a while. And, had I not done that, I wouldn't be where I am right now. But, 2007 to 2019 practice of law active, I got my training, I got my skills, I got my life experience. I got my human detection, body language, character reading skills. So I got the experience I needed to jump off a proverbial cliff and grow my wings as I was falling down, because if I were doing that now still, oh boy, I'd be very cranky and I'd probably be in the same office in the same physical and spiritual cubicle.
Well, and it's funny how things work out, because, in 2019, you wouldn't have had any clue that 2020 was coming, or every year after that. I mean, like, it's been nothing but insanity then, right? Like, you had 1 year. You had maybe 1 year of like, well, this isn't so bad. This is interesting. And then, I mean, all hell breaks loose, and it's been a wild ride ever since.
True, but you know, even the 2 years that now I look back in retrospect, my 2 years of discovering YouTube censorship started with my Alex Jones deposition breakdown in April 2018.
Tell me about that then. So because for me, you know, certainly my introduction to YouTube pulling videos and then removing my channel completely was Peter McCullough.
Mm-hmm.
And then this guy named Chris Barber, who, I mean,
I'm going to have Chris Barber on sooner than later. We've been in touch, and it was
one of the videos that one day my channel was just disappeared.
Wow.
And it was during the Freedom Convoy. And I was like, that's wild. This is wild. Right. Like, anyways, so I'm very interested then to hear about a guy who saw it early on. Tell me all about it.
I detected chicanery. I even made a playlist. People could still find it, called YouTube Chicanery. I made a shirt that was said chicanery because I realized there was chicanery afoot at YouTube. But I was so naive and stupid and wet behind the ears. And I thought, you know, if I'm a good boy, then a good boy, be polite, don't swear. I've since given up on that. I'll be fine. I'll be good. And by and large, I think I've succeeded in, you know, not having my channel taken down, because even when I break the rules, I don't break the rules to break the rules. It's, you know, incidental. But I started in, I'd say 2016, 2017 with the vlog. I think it was maybe a little later, but give or take. And the vlog was cringe, me sitting in a room doing neutral breakdowns of legal issues, because as I was leaving the practice of law and I started working for a buddy who had a marketing firm, and I was putting out daily vlogs or daily videos for 2 years, like Casey Neistat, but minus the editing and, you know, storytelling, 2016 to 2017, give or take. And so I would do these videos. They would be random hit and misses. But every time I did a video, a day in the life of a lawyer, preparing for an examination, preparing for a trial, those videos would get consistent traction, like 10, 15,000 views. And people would say, I love this, do this. And it became my niche. And so then I started doing like a day in the life of a lawyer, how to prepare for a trial, how to prepare a witness. And they were fun, humorous vlogs. Then I started doing like legal breakdowns, analyses of current legal topics. I did the Bill C-16 analysis at the time, talking about Jordan Peterson's raising the alarm. And at the time, naive, wet behind the ears, totally not red-pilled, let alone black-pilled suppository. I was like, okay, Jordan Peterson's got some, he's got some decent arguments, but I think he might be a little bit in panic mode. You know, it's questionable legislation, and there's an expression, bad cases make for bad law, but we hadn't had the bad cases to make the bad law yet. We just had the bad law to make the bad cases. And so I did these, you know, neutral breakdowns. But then I started noticing, like, I talk about something, even in a neutral manner, it would get demonetized. I was like, what the hell is that getting demonetized for? Anything that ever mentioned, well, Jeffrey Epstein, I now know why, but can't think of any concrete examples offhand. They would get demonetized. Then I did the Alex Jones video deposition breakdown. It was 2018, give or take. And I remember it, short hair, sunglasses on the roof of my old house in Montreal. Cringe, like cringe is nobody's business. But the news at that time was that sound clip, Alex Jones saying, at the time I was suffering from a form of psychosis. And that was the only clip they were playing from that deposition in the mainstream media. So I was like, what the hell? I'll go watch the deposition. It was 3.5 hours long. I watched the 3.5 hour deposition. I'm like, holy crap. The media's lying to us. So then I was like, oh my, I'm just going to do a summary of this deposition. It's like, I'm not taking any sides. I was actually critical of Alex Jones for what he said, in as much as I've always been, but there's still limits to the level of criticism. But so I break it down. I was like, here are the clips. Here's why this is a bad interrogation tactic or deposition tactic. Here's why a lawyer should not be submitting evidence to a witness that the lawyer themselves have fabricated or manufactured. And I went through the deposition, and the video got up to like 250,000 views on YouTube, which wasn't my biggest video, but it was my biggest law video. And then I forget the order. It was demonetized. I was like, what the hell? And then it was removed for violating terms of services, TOS, as relates to hate speech. And I'm like, even Alex Jones in his deposition didn't say anything hateful, but even if they could construe it as that, all I did was a legal analysis of this. And I'm like, oh, this is what censorship is about. There are some either sacred cows, or there are some, what's the guy's name? Voldemorts. names that you can't mention. I didn't realize how controversial a figure Alex Jones was at the time. And then I realized, holy crap, YouTube it's got some cracks in its otherwise pristine veneer of a video hosting platform. And that's when I started realizing YouTube was a bit of a political entity. And then, you know, 2020 happened and holy crap, it just hit steroids. And then that's when the rest of the world, or at least the rest of the sane world with two eyes and a half a brain, realized YouTube is a political entity and not a video hosting platform.
Yeah, you know, you talk about being green and wet behind the ears, and you know, I go, at times I still am, you know, like I don't think it can get any worse, or I don't realize how bad maybe it's been, you know, like I go back and I watch the Jordan Peterson's compelled speech and all that, and I'm like, it isn't that bad, is it? And then you know, you wake up, you read some headlines, you see some things going on, you're like, no, it's getting bad.
Worse.
Yeah, it's getting worse.
Sean, oh, it's Lily Tomlin. It's the header in my Twitter bio. No matter how cynical you get, it's difficult to keep up. And I just yesterday listened to an Alyssa Milano podcast with, I think the woman's name is Katie Brooks, who wrote a book called Transistor. In the interview, she explains how she transitioned her son, puberty blockers, onto hormone therapy at 12 years old. I mean, it's like, yeah, no, we've gotten to a point where it's beyond our wildest cynical black-pilled dreams, and it doesn't seem to have hit the bottom of the barrel just yet.
And Alyssa Milano, I'm assuming, is for it.
Oh yeah, it was a puff.
She was celebrating it.
You allowed your child to be himself, and it was. I put together an 8-minute highlight of this. I mean, that evil is not an appropriate word. That you have a mother who, in my view, clearly mentally unwell herself, talking about, you know, imputing gender ideology on a 5-year-old kid, then talking about how the kid becomes 8 and says, "I feel like a girl," and then they put their kid on puberty blockers, and then they put the kid on irreversible hormone therapy, and then Alyssa Milano's like, "Yeah, this is what it means to protect trans kids." But yeah, no, all that say that might be a separate discussion. When in 2016, when we were worried about compelled speech, Canada was ahead of the insanity curve of the rest of the world. And Jordan Peterson was ahead of the curve in terms of being correct as to where it was going, because it's gone there and then some.
Then some. Yeah. And I just keep waiting for it's funny. I don't even want to go listen to it. You know, like my wife, bless her, you know, sits beside, and you go into all these rabbit holes, you know, because what you're talking about, I just see Viva tip of the spear. That's, you know, like you're going and listening to all these things, and for most of us, we're not going to go do that, right? And certainly I sit here and I go, like, I talk to, you know, anywhere between 4 and 5 different people a week. That's what I do, and I hear some of it is just hard, you know, and then you got to go back to your, you know, I got 3 young kids, beautiful wife, great family, protected at all costs, and just see some of the insanity of the world. And at times it's like full on depressing of like where we're at and where we're heading. And some of the things the world is celebrating, you're like, you are batshit crazy to think that, to like think that, you know, like a child, you should be transitioning and giving them all that junk that they can't get back from. And
it's crazy, an understatement. It's like, I don't read the Bible, but I know a number of verses, but it's literally like evil has become good. And you have people who say what it means to protect, and I put it in quotes for the podcast version, what it means to protect a trans child is to allow them to make lifelong, permanent body altering decisions at the age of 12. And then the ultimate irony, and I got into a little trouble on Twitter this week because I inadvertently insulted a 14-year-old kid in a tweet where I replied to a tweet not knowing the kid was 14 years old. And all of a sudden, Viva's bullying a 14-year-old kid on Twitter. You know, on the one hand, the very same people who want to allow a 12-year-old to, you know, take hormone therapy to permanently alter their bodies, to change the way they look for the rest of their lives, to cause them all sorts of lifelong problems, you know, when it's convenient, we'll say, you can't call a 14-year-old kid stupid. I mean, that's even if you didn't know that they were a 14-year-old Twitter user. So the contradictions, the hypocrisy is stunning. It's brazen and it's evil. But look, you know, we started noticing it with censorship pre-2020 on YouTube. And then it was just so mild, and everyone thought if you weren't Alex Jones, it wouldn't be your problem. And then it became
everyone's problem.
It became everyone's problem. It became a sitting president of the United States' problem.
You know, it's it goes back to World War II, and they what's the quote? What's the you know, I didn't stand up because they came for the Jews, and then they came for, and then they, and eventually they come for you, but there's nobody left to stand up, and like, you know, it's ringing true. And more and more and more and more the farther we go along. Like, it just keeps getting, you know, it just keeps getting more and more. And you're like, what is going to take to get everybody to snap out? Let's go.
It's going to be too late. It's at first they came for the union workers, but I said nothing because I wasn't a union worker. And then I forget the progression. Then they came for me and there was nobody to say anything. You know, like, when it was the Alex Jones, and now you see in retrospect how they do it, they take the most disfavored socially, politically, whatever, that have been disfavored because of their monopoly over the media, but that's a, you know, that's part of the game. They start with the disfavored, they start with the politically unpopular, so that's like, okay, so long as I'm not an Alex Jones and I don't make a mistake on a public tragedy, I'll be fine.
Here, Viva, just so we get it right, I'm like, I'm sitting here, I'm like, I might as well get the stupid quote right. You know, not, it's not a stupid quote, by the way.
Don't worry, Clifford, you're going to get canceled now, Sean.
First they came for the communists and I did not speak out because I was not communist. Then they came for the socialists and I did not speak out because I was not socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews and I did not, and you get it, because there's nobody left to stand up, right? I mean, like, you know, and on it goes, right? And today is a different version of that, but it's the same bloody thing, you know? And I talk about this lots, and I throw myself under the bus because I got three older brothers, and we've argued about a lot of things. I remember when Donald Trump was getting pulled from Twitter, and at the time I was like, man, I don't think a president should be able to say all, and I just didn't realize, you know, it's like going to Jordan Peterson, the compelled speech. When he's saying it, it's really hard to understand what he's talking about if you can't see where it's heading. And the thing about getting Donald Trump removed off Twitter, so at the time I'm like, I don't know, should a president be able to say that? I don't know. And now I'm like, yep, 100%, because what happens is if they can take down the president of the United States, they take down every... Well, we watched it play out on Twitter.
Sure. If they can take down the president, they are the president. That's what people have to understand. How, if I may ask, how old are you?
37.
37. So we're roughly the same vintage. My retrospect.
You're a late. You're a 79, aren't you?
79. I made the disco baby. 79. I'm 44 now. But no, my retrospective. Oh yeah, that's where I went wrong. Was the Iraq War. Not so much 9/11, because I remember questioning some things, but my looking back and saying, oh, among friends at McGill, I said, oh, yeah, well, you know, Iraq is violating UN protocol, UN resolutions. They have weapons of mass destruction because they have Scud missiles. So those, you know, technically they're in violation. I remember making those arguments. And it's only now in retrospect, looking back, where I say, yeah, they said they had weapons of mass destructions and they went in and killed 250,000 Iraqi civilians. And then when they didn't find them, they had to move the goalposts and say, okay, well, they don't have chemical weapons because they couldn't find any evidence of that. But they had Scud missiles. So technically, I didn't appreciate the politically moving goalposts of the time. In retrospect now, regime change, resource wars, you know, I understand where I was wildly wrong then. And I guess in a way, I mean, I'm lucky I was younger. There was no internet, so I don't have like tweets saying, gotta go to war with Iraq, Saddam Hussein's public enemy number one. Not that I was even like that back then, but I was amenable to the arguments back then, in the same way that you were amenable to, well, you know, should a president say certain things? The irony now, Sean, and we both know it, although I sort of knew it at the time, when they took Trump off Twitter, and they took Trump off Facebook, they took it off to hide the exonerating videos and the exonerating tweets and the ones that were saying respect law enforcement. They took it down to conceal his exonerating evidence, not to protect from the incriminating evidence. They did that so they can then say he promoted violence and didn't condemn the violence and didn't promote peace, which we now know was a bold-faced lie. But that and my ultimate, you know, black pill suppository is, if that doesn't wake people up, what help? What hope is there? I've got friends during COVID who I said, this doesn't make any sense. How I said, do you think it's acceptable that they say literally you can protest BLM because racism is a public health crisis, but you can't have a gathering for political for politics? And when they say, yeah, that's a problem, but you know, they're the experts, I'm like, okay, well, there's no waking that person up. There's no red pilling that blue pill sheep. What do we do? How many of them are there? How many idiots like this are there who are maintaining the system? And that's been my progressively difficult black pill to deal with. I don't know what it takes to wake certain people up. I don't know if they can be woken up. And at this point in time, given the implementation of the jab and many people who have given this to their kids, there's some people who will just, for their own ego, for their own self-protection, they will never be able to be woken up because they will never allow themselves to be woken up to realize that they were lied to. And as a result of those lies, they might have put at risk the very people they were put on this earth to protect.
So, yeah, this is something, you know, I think a lot of us talk about, right? It's like, what is it going to take to wake more people up? I mean, I guarantee, and you would know this because you started to see the censorship starting to happen before 2020. This conversation is not new. This has been going on for a very long time. That are like, you know, just there's people going back to JFK. They're going, what is it going to take? And there's a lot of those folks that are very happy about 2020 and the years because there's a ton of people snapping out of it. I'm like, holy crap. Like, certainly, you know, one of the hardest moments of my life is sitting in Ottawa with the likes of, you know, Chris Barber and Tamara Leach and others. And I'm not sitting, we're sitting on a park bench, but you kind of get the sense. I'm in the same hotel and we're all sitting there and Prime Minister Trudeau is talking about a whole bunch of things and not meeting with anybody. And I'm, and the CBC's not taught. And I watched a panel, should have never done that. I watched a panel where they talked about the protest and I'm like literally looking out the window and they're talking about it on the screen. And I'm going, this is fucked. Like, they're not talking about anything that's going on in front of my eyes right now. And I almost had to, like, go, like, am I seeing this straight?
Sean, I got family friends. I never want to say anything that would allow anyone to identify anyone, but I've got family friends in the Ottawa area. Smart people, like, educated. The 1% in terms of education, good fortune in terms of family upbringing. They still firmly believe the truckers were racist, xenophobes, anti-Semitic, and that it was an occupation, that it was violent, that it was the end of the world. They lived in the area. They never stepped 1 foot at the actual protest to see what was going on. And it's to say, like, they were not close friends, but have certainly had strained maintaining of distant friendships as a result, because people. They were there. They lived in the area and they didn't leave their homes
to go take a look.
They didn't leave their homes to go take a look, but they hadn't left their homes in 2 years. And you say it goes back to JFK. It goes back to George Orwell. It goes back to
Mark. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I just mean certain people. It could go back as far as you want.
I didn't mean to attack you.
No.
It goes back. Mark Twain, you know, history doesn't repeat, but it tends to rhyme. Like, this has been going on mutatis mutandis in one form or another since civilization has existed. But you know, you look back at the last 3 years and you look back at literal isolation. Like, well, I'm not talking, you know, exaggerating. Isolation, social isolation, psychological abuse, economic abuse. And you look at how a society can be manipulated and controlled. And these people who have been stuck in their houses for the last 2 years, made to fear literally the presence of another human, are looking at the same media that has lied to them forever. Yeah, and say, this is the enemy right here. And they don't know shit from Shinola, to use an old expression.
So two things stick out to me, you know, when you talk about people in the Ottawa area not going down to it. I went and listened to a guy speak at a church probably, I don't know, 3 months after Ottawa, roughly. And he was just talking about his experience in Ottawa. And he was from Ottawa. And I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. And he came to Lloyd and I was like, I got to go listen to this. Like, this should be interesting. And he talked about not wanting to go down there because what he was hearing on the news said, like, these people are, but he's like, you know what? It's in my town. I need to go see it for myself. And so he's literally on stage, Viva. And he's like walking in. He's like, he's got his mask on and he's walking and he's like, you know, he's got his guard up. And he says, it's like in the first 30 seconds, he's like, what the hell? Like, what is this? And then he's like high-fiving people. And he says after the first 30 seconds, he's like, oh my God. He pulls his mask off. He's like, this is amazing. He's like, and he drives, turns, runs back to his car, drives all the way home, gets his family. And they're like, no, we're not going. He's like, get in the vehicle. And they all go down, right? And now he's going across Canada telling, I can't even remember his name, but he's telling this story of, like, you know, what I saw on the television did not match what was going on.
Can you imagine? I mean, you remember living it now in retro, in not in hindsight, but, you know, living it in reverse. And Kierkegaard, best expression ever, life can only be understood backwards, but must be lived forwards. Living it forwards at the time. Nazi flag, Confederate flag, plastered all over media.
Burning,
defacing the monument.
Yes. The Terry Fox thing, everything. Everything.
And I'm sitting there and I'm seeing the same things, like, oh my, oh, this is another January 6th. And now I want to go back and retroactively, you know, we go back and retroactively look at what January 6th was, not what the media said it was. But without getting into that example, I'm getting calls like, Viva, you got to come down here because it's not what you're seeing on the news. I was like, okay, I'm going to go. I thought I was going. And when I arrived the Monday after the Friday when it started, I thought people were going to accuse me of saying, Viva, why did you go live stream this? Now people are going to see in real time these awful stories and it's going to discredit the trucker movement. I was like, if reality is reality, it's not up to me to twist it or distort it. And people saw it in real time and I saw it in real time. But man, once you understand that the media has always lied to you, but the lies have been not more nuanced, just less impactful. So, you know, lying about Stephen Harper, well, that's just politics. Lying about the war in the Middle East, well, that's just politics and that affects Iraq. That doesn't affect me. Lying to me about everything of the last 3 years of my life, you know, lying about effectiveness of lockdowns, curfews, et cetera, et cetera. You know, once you realize the extent to which they'll lie, the remorselessness with which they'll lie, and the lack of accountability with which they'll lie. I don't know how anybody doesn't get blackpilled, but there's a lot of people who have barely even taken the red pill, but we'll continue working on those people.
Yeah. Yes. And I'm curious your thoughts. To me, come from, you know, I was joking with you before. I come from the land of the redneck is kind of the way the media kind of tries to frame it. You know, I think they're great people with great values is the way I look at it. Right. Just, we're not in one of the big cities, and certainly grew up on the farm and come from a rural background. And one of the things that I just, it was like day one of being in Ottawa. We went to the Tim Hortons on the corner of, it was just a busy place. And I met this guy along the way, a good friend now, Tian. And he's sitting there in the Tim Hortons and he has this ability to talk to anyone, especially the people that hate his guts, in a friendly manner that, you know, just kind of puts them on their back foot. Anyways, everybody's walking in with masks and he keeps telling them, hey, can I see your smile and take down your mask? And I remember this one guy being so terrified and he eventually convinces him. And why he's terrified is he's worried if he gets seen without his mask on that he'll lose his job. And I'm just like, oh my God, the level of terror in Ottawa is on a level that I didn't know existed. You know, like I come from a back where we just didn't have that level of terror, you know? And the thing about the cities, Viva, I guess I was just curious your thoughts on it, is like they're living in a world, you know, every time I see a person wearing a mask, I'm like, man, they're in a different world than me. Maybe they are worried about COVID. Maybe they are worried about germs and everything. Or maybe they've been so indoctrinated by the media and their living quarters, they have no idea this world even exists outside where you could just pull down your mask and go about life and it's okay.
There's many angles to this. First of all, just the small town thing, and you make the joke, you know, the self-deprecating redneck stuff. You know, I grew up in Montreal, and not big city by any means, but again, you know, living life in retrospect, the movies that come out of Hollywood demonize small town America. You got The Deliverance, make them, you know, like hillbillies, criminals, incestuous, dumb, all this. It's not that anyone's more beautiful than another, but small town America, my wife is from a place called Bedford. It's beautiful. Small towns are beautiful, I think, because they still have a charm that big cities don't, which is the lack of anonymity, but not in the intrusive sense, just in the sense that you can't be an asshole and then disappear into a skyscraper apartment building. People will know, and you have a little bit more accountability to your neighbors and friends. That lacks in big city life, but not in the smaller communities that sometimes arise out of big city. When I see people, getting back to the face masks, first thing to say about that, when I was testified at the NCI, the National Citizens Inquiry, and they said, you know, like, oh, the media was saying the truckers were harassing and berating people who were wearing masks. And I'm like, no, they weren't. Because everybody knew that a lot of people were wearing masks there to hide their faces from the government because they didn't want to be seen at the protest because they would get in trouble at work if they were seen there. Everybody knew that. I talked to a number of people who said, Don't put me on camera. I don't want to be identified. They're wearing masks. Nobody was judging anybody for wearing a mask because everyone knew that was at least one of the very legitimate reasons for which they were wearing them. But I went back to Montreal for the summer, drove from Florida to Montreal with my kid and two special needs dogs. And then, you step foot onto the island, set aside the construction, the green cones, the homelessness, the city looks like a dilapidated, depressing, to quote The Simpsons, pee-pee-soaked heck hole. But setting aside all of that, I see people wearing masks. I'm like, yeah, I've stepped back into the asylum. These are broken people. These are people who 3 years out of COVID, I'll still try to give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they have COVID. Maybe they're sick and they don't want to get other people sick. Fine. We're in the middle of the summer and I'm seeing people wearing face masks on the street. These are people who have been broken by the system. They've been broken by their handlers, and they're so far broken they don't even realize it. And I got nothing but empathy and sadness for them until such time as their brokenness becomes my problem because they want to impose whatever mandate, whatever restrictions on me. But I just feel bad for them. And yes, people were like living in fear on the one hand, or living in fear on the other, fear of being identified, or fear 3 years out that mere human presence can possibly kill them. There can't be a sadder existence. I had an argument with someone, family friend, smart person, who said, wear a mask outside. I was like, why the hell would I need to wear a mask outside? And they said, well, if I'm crossing you and you sneeze, I was like, you think that I have to wear a mask outside in the unlikely event that I'm an asymptomatic COVID carrier and I happen to sneeze at the moment you cross paths with me and you happen to inhale that particle outdoors and you might get sick. And even if that, all of that infinitesimally small stuff occurs, you'll still have a 99.9 whatever percent survival. You think that's why I need to wear a mask outside? You're fucking crazy. And a nice family friend, and it was not it wasn't an aggressive way that I did this, but I said that. And you realize that people have just stopped thinking. Fear is the ultimate catalyst to making terrible, terrible decisions. But that was an actual conversation I had with a lifelong family friend. I think we're still friends, but we haven't seen each other in a long time. But yeah, nuts, nuts, just irrational fear.
Yeah, fear is the mind killer, isn't it? I mean, like...
There's a few, hatred is a mind killer. Fear is a mind killer. Negative pathogens, like to quote Gad Saad, are mind killers. The good stuff is the good stuff. So you got to try to fill your mind with the inverse to hate and fear, which is not love in a cliched sense, but knowledge and wisdom.
I'm going to switch gears here for a second because I got something in the back of my brain since you said it that I've been kind of like, I'm like, Sean, write it down, get it out of your head because it's going to sit there. But you mentioned a guy named Casey Neistat, right? And I'm going back to your early vlogging days, your days on YouTube where you started doing one a day, and you said you did it for 2 years.
Yep.
I've had this thought. I think it's a crazy thought, but once upon a time when I first started the podcast, Viva, it was one day a week. I did a podcast a week, and then, it went to two, then it went to three, then it to four, and then I got up to five, and, you're just like, and people are like, are you insane? I'm like, I don't know. I just, you go back to your icky guy, and I go, yeah, I don't know. I love it, and I thought I'd run out of people to talk to, but here, there's 8 billion people, and it seems like our media just keeps screwing people over, and they just keep coming, and I'm like, I don't know. I don't think I'm running out anytime soon. I've had this idea of once upon a time of 365 and 365 for a podcast. I personally think it's a little bit insane. Like you're biting off a lot. But you talk about doing it for two straight years. What did you learn out of that? Like, and why did you do it?
It's interesting. So this is 2016 when I made the mental decision to wind up my litigation practice. So 2016 to 2018, I'm not taking any new clients. I'm winding up all of the files that I have, and I'm giving away, or not giving away in a generous sense. I'm finding replacement lawyers for the files that are going to be ongoing. I'm not really working as a lawyer, and I'm also not making any money as a lawyer. We still had our lawyers working with us, and so I'm working to not make money, to give my files away. Still have a couple of lawyers that we need to pay. And I was like, well, I want to try it. I want to do it. And now that I'm not doing law as a practice on a daily basis, I can put that attention into something else. And it wasn't like, my goodness, it wasn't Casey Neistat level edited videos all the time. Some of them were much more edited, much more storytelling than others. Others were just short videos of something that was amazing that happened that day. What I learned, it was an amazing thing. It was Casey Neistat's. Have you seen this video? Three words to get to 3 million followers.
Yes,
and it's just
One of the guys on my list of eventually dream guests is Casey Neistat, and I have to tell the story of Casey Neistat over and over and over again. But I stumbled. I don't know how the heck I stumbled on it. But anyways, yes, carry on. Sorry.
And I know, and I stumbled on Casey right after he finished his 2 years of daily videos. Remind me to say about the Casey Neistats, I'd love to interview them as well, but I think, I at this point I've become too political for some people on the other side.
Well, and you're right on the fairness. I feel like some days I've become ridiculously way too political. I started doing, I've had the Don Cherry and the Ron McLean and the Glenn Sather and the Brian Burke and all the hockey guys. That's my.
I noticed the hockey jersey in the back there.
Literally in 2021, I go from interviewing nothing but hockey. I just jettisoned so many people because I'm just doing interesting hockey story. It started out community hockey, lessons learned, and COVID hits, and I'm like, okay, I'm not going to talk about this. This is gonna, eventually we're gonna get over this, and it just never does, and it gets this level of insanity where finally I'm like, I got to start talking about this, and then I made the conscious choice. I'm not going to talk about anything until this is done. I'm going to talk about COVID until it is done. And I had a lot of people very upset. I had a lot of people very happy about that too, but I had a lot of people very upset. And what happens over the course of a year until you get to the Freedom Convoy is, how do you go back? It's like, well, I would love nothing more to have Don Cherry on. And I don't need to talk COVID with him. I just like to talk some serious thoughts on where he is in there. Except they probably look at me now. Well, I've tried, for the listener, I've tried getting Don Cherry back on. And he's, the way I've gone through about it, they just said, no, we're not interested. I'm like, well, that's probably fair. Anyways, carry on.
Yeah, no, and I've been doing the interviews where occasionally have someone on who it's nothing related to COVID. It's nothing related to detransitioning. I had Chloe Cole on, Tulip R. Ritchie. I mean, I can, despite what people might think of me from my Twitter persona, I can have a discussion with someone who I vehemently disagree with. And it would be a great discussion. The problem is there are ideological lines where people will not want to discuss with me because they will literally get fired or canceled as a result. And I've had people, basically confirm to me in DMs, I just can't do it. Like I'll get I cannot even associate with you. I'll get accused of fraternizing.
Isn't that a wild thing, Viva?
It's nuts. But we're, we have the luxury of not having a boss, not having, not beholden to anybody. Someone says, I'm going to come at it. I'm my own boss, F you. And even if I had employees, I wouldn't fire them because some activist tells me to, because they're angry that they, put out.
Yeah, I agree.
But
after I went to Ottawa and came back and everything, I had a friend go, I don't know if I can have you on my show because you might be radioactive right now.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And I was like,
before you post that picture to social media, understand you might get some negative comments just by taking a Christmas picture with me, because they post it to Facebook and then things happen. Anyhow, now hold on. All that to say, bringing it back, that was Casey Neistat.
Sorry, the videos again. To me, I'm very curious about 365 and 365.
What it taught me was A, discipline. And B, learning the trade, so that when you force yourself to sit down and edit a video, if it's 11 o'clock at night and you only have an hour left, you're going to learn to edit fast. You're going to develop techniques, strategies, and you get good at the skill. And it's only 2 years later when a story breaks in the news and you got to, when I jump in my car and get to, make a vlog, I can think, I can script in my head, I can shoot the content, and I can edit together an entertaining, humorous, I'd say reasonably interestingly edited video in 5 hours. Well, you've just acquired a skill that you didn't know you were building that muscle when you were building it, but you were building muscles when you did it. With interviews 365, I think the risk there could be, because I thought about this as well, if you're fatigued, it could impact the manner in which you interact with a guest, which, making a video when you're cranky and tired, when it doesn't impact anybody else other than you, that's one thing. But that could be a nuance with the idea of a 365 interview a day.
I was just going to say, the crazy thing is one of the happiest places in the planet that I have is this chair, because I get to, don't get me wrong, I love being around my family and everything, folks, but this chair, like right now, you know, I go, you know, over the course of the last week and change, you know, I got to sit with, you know, an in-person is 1,000 times better than video, but mm-hmm. video, in my opinion, and me and Trish Wood would disagree on this. I think this is better than a phone call in my humble opinion. But regardless, you know, Chris Barber today, Leighton Cray yesterday, you know, you're coming out Monday. And I go like, what other place in the world do I get to have this? Oh, such an array of conversations. And I am, I think, a little bit different in that you know, I'll gladly talk to. I got a guy coming on who swam 100 and I think it's 107 kilometers in 72 hours. It's something insane.
On purpose, or did he like fall out of a plane?
No. and I'm interested about it. Certainly, you know, there's a lot of craziness going on in the world. I want to talk about it, but I also want to. There's some great things going on in the world, and I want to shed some light on it too. Because I just can't live in the world of craziness. Like at some point, I just go a little bit wonkers for sure. Well, too. Anyways, regardless, I hear you. I go, but I'm like the one thing I think that I could pull off with 365. The only thing I'm like, there's no day off. I'm like, that's tough, but I love it. You know, like I don't know what it is. I just love it. And I'm preaching to the choir. Cause I mean, obviously what you
I like you say, the Ica guy is one thing, but the other expression, you know, if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life.
Isn't that right?
I would be doing this for nothing. I was doing this when I was making nothing. I remember the first month when I made $5,000 in AdSense revenue. I was like, holy crap, I'd struck gold. I can actually, you know, survive doing what I love, where I was, you know, indebting myself by doing it and not making it, you know, any money off of it. But no, so it's a blessing. It is a little depressing where, you know, people just, they will not come on, even though we have something to talk about. I've crossed the bridge a couple of times. I had on, she's a teacher out of Toronto. Her name is Jo Unlearn 16, where you need to find someone on the other side who also, in order to prove a point, will cross that divide. But the number of people who I think I have otherwise legitimate discussion, legitimate questions, to say, I can't do it, I'll get in trouble at work. You're too far right, even though, you know, whatever, calling me far right is a joke. But no, just to what is it, put a bow in the daily thing was learning how to edit quickly, learning a skill. And I didn't realize at the time that would come in very handy later on with just editing together vlogs when a story would break. And then the other fringe benefit was I was still able to, you know, license some of those videos that would sometimes go viral. I discovered a news licensing agency called Newsflare, upload there. You could sort of make some passive revenue doing that. So it taught me a number of things. It also taught me how to, like, you know, consider your assets when you're going to make a video. Like, what do I have today that will be of interest for a video? And another just incidental thing, although I didn't really need this reminder, it teaches you to pay attention to the detail of what is going on in life, not from the cynical, first, let me get a selfie perspective. Just like, crap, I'm walking down the street the other day, and there's a bunch of ants carrying a lizard off to, you know, it's already dead. It's carrying it off to the dead. Like when you're constantly paying attention for those little beautiful moments, you end up seeing a lot more stuff than you might otherwise ignore.
So every day Viva's looking for little insights in the world.
Every day I'm looking. If I find something that I think is going to go viral, I'm lucky. I got the Viva Family Channel, so I can put the non-political stuff there. and you know, you could. I don't know if you saw the video that I shot. I was in the Florida Keys last week. We went to a place called Robbie's Marina, which is in Isla Morada, sort of halfway down, and it's a place where you can hand feed minnows to giant tarpon, and I mean like 6-foot tarpon. And I'm there with my kids. My daughter is holding a minnow, and this 6-foot tarpon jumps out of the water. And when I say envelops, I mean envelops her entire arm. And I was recording in slow motion. This fish comes out, like gets her arm into its mouth up to the elbow. Doesn't hurt. They got sandpaper teeth. It pulls the fish off. The reaction was glorious. And I was like, oh, crap, that is a video that is going to be interesting to a licensing agency. And you end up making a little bit of side hustle off what you would otherwise be doing anyhow. And it, you know, it conditions you to always be looking for these moments, these memories that if you find it interesting, chances are someone else will as well.
Tell me about Florida, because you know you're originally from Montreal. When did you make the move? Why did you make the move?
Well, that's COVID and COVID is why. I never in a million years did I ever think I would leave my home country. Never in a billion years did I think I would get chased out of my home country. COVID hit, and I remember March 2020. My parents lived up the street, or they still live up the street, and I was down the street. And the world went just shut down. I mean, shut down. I remember talking to one of my brothers in the United States, and he, you know, worked in a business that was reliant on tourism. And I remember like the sorrow, the sadness. And my father's like, yeah, we're going to see how the world can go crazy in short order. I was like, okay, well, you know, it'll blow over by the summer. It'll blow over in a couple weeks, a couple months, yada, yada. And then it just kept on getting worse and worse and worse. And I realized like, holy shit, like now I'm discovering some laws that I wasn't aware were on the books. The Quarantine Act, this law out of Quebec to remove parental supremacy from the Youth Protection Act. Then you get Bill C-16. Then you start talking about online. I mean, I don't remember when all of these things came to be, but you start realizing there's a lot of laws that are going to make life not livable anymore if you are paying attention to this. Then it was the determinant one was the vaccine passport. And I mean, everybody knows it. I got the jab for my own reasons, which if I knew then what I knew now, you'd have to tie me down to give it to me. But then I didn't really even fully appreciate how harmful something like a little substance could be. But I wasn't about to do this to my kids, and my wife and I were on the same page. When they had that vaccine passport system that applied to kids 13 and up, I was like, we're going to have to leave because I'm not doing this. And even if they rescind this bullshit tyrannical policy, I'm not living in a country that creates these types of vaccine taxes, vaccine passports, makes 13-year-old kids show a QR code to play. I said, I realized that we were going to have to leave. And I started dropping the joke lightly to my wife. I was like, Florida's looking better and better every day. And then she hit her moment when, I don't remember the year, but it was 2022, give or take, and my kid is at her high school, and they're doing the high school play or the musical, whatever it is. And like, A, they asked my kid for her QR code. And she's like, I'm 12. I don't need to show you this. And they gave her attitude. And my wife is like, they're making a fucking 12-year-old kid almost cry to get into the school play. And then my wife says, she gets in there and they're wearing face masks, the students, while singing this musical. And she's like, this was an insane asylum. And she's like, that's it, we're out. And in the meantime, what ended up happening was, I mean, a lot of people were looking for ways out. I affiliate with Rumble where they're like, okay, we need, we're up and growing. We need Canadian legal expertise. We need your skill set. And we enter into an agreement, which then facilitated my getting a visa to come down for 3 years. And that's how I ended up here. And then, you know, people say, how's Florida here? You're in the land of bigotry, racism, transphobia, hair DeSantis. And like the only people who are so wildly misinformed about Florida are sitting, living up in censorship, you know, central Canada, reading the CBC's demonizing DeSantis in Florida for everything it's not. The other than the wild heat, humidity, flatness, stagnant pond water, I like mountains, I like cold rivers, I like you know, being able to jump into fresh water, which you can't do here. Other than that, politically, spiritually, it's a beautiful place. And you know, the kids are leading a normal life. They're not living in a world where, when we were driving down here, another memory that will stick with me forever, when we were driving down and we hit New York State or one of the hotels overnight, and like my kids have been conditioned to like not get in an elevator with another human, not because they're scared, but because it elicits a negative reaction from the person who's terrified to be in an enclosed space with kids, the vectors of disease. My kids have been brought up to be told that they are vectors of disease that are going to kill granny and pops. And so we're on the way down, like, can we get in the elevator? I was like, yes, we can get in the elevator because we're not in the land of the crazy anymore. So from that perspective, from a child development perspective, invaluable. And we'll see what the future holds, but that's how we ended up here. And what Canadians think they know of Florida policy and law, they're wildly ill-informed because they're relying on state-funded propaganda to misinform them about Florida so they can demonize Florida so they can somehow rationalize the tyranny under which they are living.
It's every time I've heard or talked to somebody who moved from Canada down to the States at the time you're talking about, because there was a lot of conversations that went on in a lot of different circles and a lot of people left. They talk about different little moments of like, yeah, no, we don't have to do that anymore. And hearing you talk about it just once again is almost like deja vu of some of the conversations I've had of people just getting out of Canada and some of like the insanity that went on here and going there. You've said it a couple times, and I'm curious what you mean by it. You say politically, I think politically makes sense to me. Watching DeSantis, you know, he's three, four people, maybe folks in politics in North America that have spoke a certain way towards COVID at that time and a bunch of different values. Then you mentioned spiritually, but you said at the start, you know, you aren't that spiritual or something along that lines compared to your siblings. So now I'm like, well, what does moving to Florida have to do with spirituality?
Well, I've been spiritually, not in a religious sense, just in terms of like the breathing, the fresh air of freedom, not living under constant stress, fear. And above all,
it's been
else,
good for your soul.
Yeah, like disappointment in neighbors, like that disappointment in the people that I thought were my community. You know, people who called me, extremist, selfish, because I'm like, it doesn't make sense that they're zip tying swings. It doesn't make sense that they're locking dog runs. It doesn't make sense that 2 weeks turned into 2 months. It doesn't make sense that I'm under a goddamn curfew. And I get judged by people who are smart people who contribute.
Just went along.
And judge me for being right. Judge me for being right, but judge me as an extremist, as a negative. So you get down here, and there's a ton of like, you know, blue, you call them blue people. There's a ton of Democrats. There's people with, you know, BLM flags, and there's people with gay pride sticks. And I don't sense the animosity. It's really much more of a live and let live attitude in Florida, where in Canada, it was a live the way I tell you to live. Otherwise, it's going to get ugly for you type mentality. And so that's what I mean by spiritually, in that I don't live under the constant terror of judgment of neighbors. I literally don't live under the fear of neighbors calling the cops because we're having an illicit play date or sleepover. I mean, we broke some of the COVID rules. You know, like we had indoor gatherings. I said, I've got kids. I'm not letting my kids not have play dates with our kid neighbors. And so call the cops if you see me. But you had people like looking out the window, like, what are they doing? Did he just come out of the neighbor's house? Like literally, it was crazy. It was not a healthy way to live a life.
It's funny. There will be people here, probably including myself, that don't realize you're living in that. And you wouldn't know you're living in it unless you go to somewhere where you can just feel it, right? Like I get what you mean now, right? You can just sense it. Nobody gives a shit. You're like, oh, this is nice.
No, but we come. Kids are playing on the street.
Like, yeah,
it was we and kids are playing on the street without wearing face masks. When I see kids outdoors in Montreal wearing face masks, I'm like, this is, it's psychological, if not physical abuse. My kids went into, we used to live on Green Avenue, and they went into the Avenue G. If anybody from Montreal is listening, we knew the guy there very well. They go into the coffee shop, and my kid comes out and says, like, there was not a physical fight, but a man yelled at an old lady because she was too close to him in line. And I was like, this is not normal for a kid to have to experience. I'm like, okay, yeah. I tell you, people are crazy.
It's not normal for an adult to have to experience.
I know,
I've been yelled at for standing too close to somebody. I'm like, really?
Are you crazy? But then you have kids. Like, kids are going to live in this society where they think that A, this is normal, or B, they know it's not normal, but it's a source of stress. Am I too close to this person? Are they going to get mad at me? It's unhealthy. It's physically, psychologically unhealthy. And the sun is a damn good thing as well. You know, a little sun, a little tan, vitamin D, the ocean. But did I ever think that my government would turn my house into a prison? Did I ever think that my government would chase me from my own country? It's not like, I never thought I'd ever leave Canada. I mean, even when I never thought I'd leave Montreal.
Think you'll ever come back? Now that you're staring at Canada from afar, you think you'll ever come back?
I guess that would be a two-part answer. Not if I can help it, if things don't change, and maybe if things change, maybe. But the other thing is, I not only do I not see things changing, they're getting worse. And you come down to a place where First of all, just like I love winter, but when you have three young kids and not having to dress, not having to spend 45 minutes to get dressed up so they get tired after 10 minutes and come back in, you know, vitamin D in winter, an overall physically healthier lifestyle, you know, no state income tax. People also don't realize it's not just that they turned my own country into a prison. I was financing my abusers. I was paying I was paying 50% of everything I made so that I could be abused by my government, demonized by my government, and censored by my government. I'm going to make money for Supreme Leader François Legault. I'm going to make money for Justin Trudeau so I can finance him censoring me, so I can finance him telling me what I have to do with my kids. I mean, you have to be stupid. You have to be stupid or have no choice but to do that. And I, part of me, I feel a great amount of sadness for people who are desperate to get out and can't, because they are literally trapped financing their abusers. And then I feel bad for the people who just don't realize it. Or I feel a little bit of resentment for the people who are making their money from that government, so they don't dare bite the hand that feeds them. But no, not unless I have to, and not unless things not unless things change wildly, which I don't see happening anytime soon.
Well, this is where my this is where my greenness probably appears, because I'm like still very, very hopeful, you know, with Danielle Smith being elected in Alberta and the group of people out this in Western Canada that are just very upset, very motivated, et cetera, et cetera. That things can change. But you're a guy who I don't know how much of the inside of the beast you saw, but certainly you ran for the PPC once upon a time. Mm-hmm. You know, what was... Am I just too green in thinking things can change?
The problem is, I analogize it to a black hole. Like, there is an event horizon beyond which there's no coming back. And so... I don't know how close to that political event horizon we are, but I can see it. Even who's going to save us? Pierre Poilievre? I mean, I'd never tell anybody who to vote for, full stop. Even when I was running, I didn't even ask my parents if they voted for me. I can say who I'm not going to vote for. Is Pierre Poilievre going to save us? He's the only one who can even float that as an alternative. I'll defeat Justin Trudeau and we'll take back our country. This is the same Pierre Poilievre who, you know, didn't support the truckers until it was cool to do so, and then immediately stopped supporting the truckers once the Commissioner Rouleau ratified Trudeau's Emergencies Act invocation, and it became unpopular to have supported the truckers. It's the same Conservative Party that voted unanimously for the conversion therapy ban. I forget what law it is, but the one that says you can't talk a trans or gay kid, or you can't try to talk him out of.
Yes, and that. I just had Patrick Phillips on talking about this bill, and I'm going to get text about it about 16 times. It's Bill C, and I forget.
It's like C4, C6.
C4, C6, somewhere. Yes.
But no, the Conservatives voted unanimously, and this is not a bill that prevents conversion from straight to trans, and I'll put them in quotes. This is a conversion ban that says you can't try to talk a kid out of it. It criminalizes psychiatry, psychology, and parenting. But you sure as hell can talk a straight kid and affirm that they are gay, trans, or whatever.
Yes.
So that Conservative Party is going to save Canada? And, you know, Danielle Smith, I've publicly given her a hard time when I think she deserves it. Apologizing for, you know, she comes out and she's the savior. Nobody's been more discriminated in the last few years than the unvaccinated. Then she has to bend the knee and apologize because, you know, people feigned outrage. People feigned victimhood. Is she going to save it? I'm not sure. I look at Quebec. I have nothing but political disdain for François Legault. Not only did he not get ousted from office he got more seats.
Yeah. Right?
So this is the rebellious French Canadian side of Canada that, you know, that fought hard to preserve their identity, that fought the British, bending over to Supreme Leader François Legault's tyranny. Because, I mean, to some extent, they've become captured and reliant on government. So who's going to save Canada? Not coming out of Quebec, not coming out of Ontario. I don't think it's coming out of the Conservative Party. Maxime Bernier, he's definitely not a savior any more than anybody else. I think politically he is what Canada needs, but he's not. We'll see what happens if they call a next federal election. But, you know, he couldn't get a seat in the House. And I say that not as a criticism to the party. I say that as a criticism to Canadian voters. Got almost 1 million votes across Canada, but the way the system's set up, didn't get one seat. And my goodness, law after law. I don't want to blackpill you, Sean, or your audience. Law after law. The Online Streaming Act is going to, you know, potentially not criminalize, but make it impossible for you to continue doing what you're doing out of Canada. What was the one that just passed? The link tax. That's Bill C-18. A link tax is going to kill Canadians' abilities to find independent news. It's not going to kill their ability to find CBC, Radio-Canada, CTV News, Global News, National Post, Toronto Star, because they already know those. The government's going to continue financing those so people can discover those. It's going to kill Canadians' ability to discover independent alternative media. Canadians are going to get dumber and dumber. The legislation keeps coming harder and thicker. And I think we're getting close to the event horizon where you see what happens to a country like Venezuela over the course of 30 years. Well, let's just maybe amplify that a little bit more now because it can be done in a shorter period of time. We're now entering a decade of Justin Trudeau's tyrannical regime over Canada, and the spiral to the black hole has been getting exponentially faster year over year. Sorry, I really don't want to make everyone too depressed here. I'm going to have an energy drink after this and lighten up.
It's funny. I don't think you're blackpilling anyone, Viva. Like, I mean, we've been literally talking about all this shit now for folks. It's been two solid years. It's been summer of 2021. We're in summer of 2023. It's been two straight years. Mm. This audience has been getting hammered with different stories from all across Canada. We try our best to make it as much Canadian content. We bring in other people as well, of course. We're not opposed, you know, to have other insights, but just to hear what Canadians are saying and talking about in the bills and on, it freaking goes and it does not end.
But I do think
it's good to talk about it realistically. And the thing is, I don't think you're probably firing some people up. There's nothing wrong with that.
Politically, because I genuinely, firmly, and vehemently believe violence is not and will never be the answer. As for the reason that we saw during the Canadian trucker convoy, had there actually been violence, well, then people would have been even more empowered to believe the lies. Let me put a little white lining on that black pill. There have been some discussions which had never been in the Canadian political fore, firearm rights being one of them. Like at some point, even the regime goes too far where people take a step back and say, hold on a second, why have we gotten here and why can I not own a firearm for self-defense? You know, maybe we don't want to go the American way, and I don't know, there's arguments for and against there, but maybe we don't want to go all American, but maybe we should have the right to own a firearm for self-defense, especially when crime is on the rise. How have we gotten to this point? And the firearm discussion is something that I have noticed has come back to the political fore in Canada, whereas I had never noticed it before. So maybe, you know, it's the overreach is actually creating more public discourse, more public discussion, more public awareness, and there will be a pushback. It's Ruhu Nabadu. And I hope I didn't screw up his name. When you fight corruption, corruption fights back. And the Trudeau regime is fighting back full cylinder.
So maybe it's more of a race than I give credit to. Because I go, one of the things I'm very hopeful for is no different than Viva. I go like, man, it's people like yourself that people have found these different channels. And, you know, the more they try and tell us we can't find you or others, the more the underground network just like fires off. Viva just had a great interview. You got to go listen to this and boom, away it goes. And I'm not sitting here acting like 100% of Canadians get that, but an ever-growing community certainly does. And they're becoming ever-growing more active. It doesn't mean it's not going to take time to pull out of whatever spiral we're in. But the fear is what you're talking about is they're going to clamp harder and harder, and they're trying to push harder. But as they try and push harder, everybody starts noticing more, and it goes, what's going to happen here? As you eventually hit this crossroads where something happens, and what is that?
Well, let me black line your white pill. it is true. There are some who are going to dig. You're going to create that underground movement. But what I discovered after running for the People's Party of Canada, man, I could hit the pavement. I could grind all day long, knock on doors, meet individuals. I could do my podcast. I could have my guerrilla campaigning techniques where I would call CJAD and get on air there. I could work like a beast. to reach, if I'm lucky, you know, 100,000 people in a day, including the internet. And then CBC, you know, they have a monopoly.
Certainly in Canada, you are 100% right. But wouldn't you argue, look at the United States right now. Yep. I look at guys like Joe Rogan specifically. But I mean, it goes on and on and on. Like, I mean, Tucker gets ousted from Fox. Now that guy on just on what he's doing on X now is like this is something.
Yep.
And more and more people are starting to take notice, which is, you know, like not wild. The more people that find and listen to long form discussion, I'm just all for it. But the United States is showing it. And Canada is just lagging behind because we don't have the Joe Rogan, right? We just
who's Canada's Joe Rogan? I don't want to be mean. I mean, there's Jordan Peterson, but even Canada's Joe Rogan left the country. I mean, Jordan Peterson is in the States, isn't he?
Yeah, he's in Florida.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would argue he's not Joe Rogan. He's more like I don't know. He's more like Elon Musk or something. Because Joe Rogan is very
culturally influential. There's no question about it. You're right, for good and for bad. Not for right and for wrong, for good and for bad. America, as far as it goes for independent voices, is Canada on steroids. You got Steve Bannon, you got Steven Crowder, you got Joe Rogan, you got Tim Pool, I don't want to miss anybody out of disrespect. You got Russell Brand, you got Jimmy Dore. Flip side, their censorship and their oppression or their ideological oppression is also on steroids. You know, in Canada, Trudeau only invoked the Emergencies Act. In the States, you have your January 6th where people go to jail for years. You have the weaponization of prosecution of agencies at a level you'd never see in Canada. Canada looks at that and says, holy crap, that's corrupt. True. And that's why I say, like, on the one hand, some people think they're shaming me by saying I fled Canada, and as if I need anybody to tell me that all has always been a sort of a nagging part of my psyche. Flip side, dude, at some point, the fight for Canada is not going to be able to be waged from within Canada because of what's going on in Canada. And so I come to the last place where I think there's a fighting chance to actually save the aggregate freedom. If it falls in the States, it falls everywhere. And it's going to fall in Canada. If it hasn't already before, it's going to fall in the States.
And I've had this argument lots. And I go, I think the United States needs Canada more now than ever, which means you have to, Canada needs to fight harder now than ever. Because if Canada falls, now you have no ally to the North. And Canada, you know, certainly is not carrying its weight in water right now, right? We got holes everywhere.
It's a liability. Canada's a liability to the States.
But at the same time, I go, I see, you know, you go, who's the Joe Rogan of Canada? Don't have the answer to that. But I know there's a ton of people that are doing shows just like Viva, just like Sean, and they're becoming ever more popular. The problem we have is we have a state-funded media that gets billions of dollars, and we joke about it all the time. Like, man, it'd be nice just to have a million, let alone a couple billion to fund what it is.
First of all, when I say Canada's a liability to the States, I mean like ideologically and almost militarily, yes. It's all fun and games until the States looks at Canada and says, holy crap, you guys are training Chinese soldiers for wintertime combat on Canadian soil. And so I don't mean in any sort of like...
Or the fact we have Chinese police stations.
But then, you know, I'm looking at China Joe Biden. I'm saying like maybe he doesn't care all that much because I think both the leaders
came out, Viva, and said, you know, in order to fly a spy balloon above our country, you got to follow the proper paperwork. Otherwise, it's a $25,000 fine. That was just last week. And you're like, this cannot be Canada. What the hell are we talking about?
It's outrageous. But by the way, everyone should appreciate this as well. It's not just the subsidies to state media in Canada. The two latest bills, the Online Streaming Act and the Link Tax Act, are nothing more than disguised ways of reestablishing the primacy on the digital sphere of legacy media on radio and television. It's intended to do nothing more than re-embolden or reinvigorate legacy media to the detriment of independent media. So it's, you know, the ad revenue is one thing. Accessibility is the other. And so you're going to starve off the livelihood and the accessibility of independent media. And that's not going to really hurt the state-funded legacy media. So
you think if you're sitting there, you go, Sean Newman at some point is going to be moving to the States. That's what you think. I mean, not to put words in your mouth.
and I think I've had discussions with people who don't say it publicly. I've got to get the hell out of here because my ability to do what I want, what I need to do, is being stifled. And it's also only a matter of time before I start, you know, experiencing incidental reprisals. I don't know, like audits or like, you know, other sort of government retribution. But it's and it's not even political podcasters necessarily. It's anybody who relies on a free, accessible internet that's like, well, okay, it's not going to touch me. I got a fishing channel, or I got an unboxing channel. Anybody operating in this sphere is very quickly going to experience some very serious problems in Canada. The link tax, and now that Google and Meta are pulling links to news sources, you know, it might cause a bit of a dent for Global News, CTV, CBC, Toronto Star. Well, they'll make up for it with COVID ads. They'll make up for it with subsidies. They'll make up for it with bailouts. Rebel News, not long for Canadian political landscape. True North. We'll see how it actually plays out, but you know, it's going to require crowdfunding.
When you talk about Rebel, when you talk about True North, when you talk about Western Standard, when you talk about all the ones that are trying to combat the CBC, the Global, the CTV, et cetera, the ones, you know, you mentioned the Toronto Star, all the ones that are taking state funding, that's the ones that immediately are going to be, well, they've been screaming at the top of their lungs.
And they've been having problems for a little while, so they've developed alternative models of a subsistence of survival. They've gone sort of the Alex Jones route where they have, you know, they have their direct funding. The problem is that and the other thing is, you might still be able to survive and even make a decent living, but more important than financial wealth or financial well-being, you want reach and you want to inform people. So whether or not they can continue to survive with their million subs, which I'm sure they will be able to, you want to impact and better your cultural political landscape. They will not be able to do that. And then who knows what it looks like if it gets even worse in 10 years from now. So survival is one thing, but the influence and informing the general public is another. And they will not have that opportunity, although they haven't had it for a long time, you know, since YouTube started censoring. But no, I would make the prediction that there will be an exodus. It's the brain drain and it'll be the financial drain. There's going to be the same exodus that we've seen in other nations elsewhere. People take their talent, they take their skill, and they take their finances, and it increases the collapse of the society, like a neutron star caving in itself because of its increased gravity.
If you take all the people fighting against what's going on and they all leave, then there's nobody left fighting it.
No, and then just take even business people, the people who pay the taxes,
yes,
to keep this infrastructure. It's not just like podcasters that I'm talking about. I'm talking like accountants, lawyers. Like, what the fuck? In Quebec, they with their Bill 96, like it's impossible to do business. What the hell would I stay here for? I'm financing my abusers. I'm gonna up and leave. Go to New York. New York's probably a bad example, but I'm gonna up and leave. And then what happens? You got brain drain, financial drain. You don't even have the people to tax anymore to maintain this blob of a government cancer on society. So I'm not optimistic at all. But my goodness, I can be a whole hell of a lot more vocal here with impact than I think I will be able to have been in Canada now going forward.
It's one of these discussions that I'm going to want to circle around to, because I've been talking about this since the middle of COVID, right? When people left, when literally couldn't get out of the country, you know, like I was, you know, anyways, it doesn't matter.
Can you imagine when they made districts, a red zone couldn't go to a green zone. A red zone couldn't go to a green zone within Quebec.
That was a BC thing too. Here in the prairies, we never got that far. In the prairies, the things that always stick out to me was they were talking about building quarantine centers, which I was just like, what?
I thought that was conspiracy theory, but then they realized. Well, incidentally,
they had a snitch line, Viva, where you could call in at any time. Got pranked more times than I like to count. Anyways,
the CBC ran an article, "The Joys and Perils of Snitching on Your Neighbor During a Pandemic." Everyone can Google that wonderful story. The only problem that CBC had with it, not that people would do it, that it would impact minorities. So it's okay to snitch on your white neighbor. Not okay to snitch on your black neighbor.
We should have you every Tuesday, every Monday night, we do the Tuesday mashup, me and a guy from Twitter, 222 minutes, and we read off Canadian headlines and then talk about them. We should have you join for one of those nights so you can have some fun with that.
I've got them ingrained in my psyche.
I know, but every week you think you're like, it can't get any more weird or stupid, and then you're like, oh, there it is.
Vaccine passport to get into Canadian Tire in Quebec. And I'm like, they're not doing this. And I go there. I had been sounding the alarm, not that it required much foresight. This is racism in policy. I was like, all right, I'm going to go to the Canadian Tire. I was a little ruder than I should have been, maybe, with the clerk. Who do I see not being allowed in? Lo and behold, it's a black family who, for whatever the reason, maybe because of historical government abuses, chose not to get vaccinated. They couldn't get into Canadian Tire. And this is coming from, what was some of the other classic headlines? I'll think of a few more, but no, the prairies, you had it, I guess it's maybe a less densely populated, so less fear and a little more.
No, there was still a ton of fear. And you know, like, there was still a ton of everything. Like, I mean, we had them throwing sand on outdoor rinks. We had them taping off parks, you know, like, and on it went. We had the snitch line in Saskatchewan. They hired a bunch of ex-police officers to go out and hand out tickets to all these different places. And like, we went, you know, they told us to stop taking ivermectin because it's horse medication and everything else, right? It's just like, we've lost our minds. We've literally lost our minds.
When you look back, I mean, it's insanity that they locked outdoor dog runs. The 2 meter rule and the arrows on the sidewalks. I remember the first video I saw where someone was freaking out about the arrows on the sidewalks and like, I don't see those here yet. Oh, now I see the arrows on the sidewalks, like directional arrows on the sidewalks. I remember when they shut everything down, they were still running the train, and I was video recording the train, just doing the rails. Nobody was on it. I mean, the last 3 years have destroyed let me rephrase this. I now understand how historical atrocities have occurred, having lived through the last 3 years. And I don't care if people find that statement offensive. If you now understand how societies have gone mad.
I interviewed a guy, Byron Christopher. I just saw a thing about Zuby sent something out on X saying, you know, I wonder what people after the Holocaust living in Germany said, something along that lines.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. How did they go back to living with their name? It was something I remember seeing that tweet as well.
So Byron Christopher is an old crime beat reporter from Edmonton. Phenomenal story. He's in his 70s. Got a mind like a steel trap. And he went to Germany and interviewed people that were around during the time of Auschwitz and different things like that. Mm-hmm. And he interviewed one woman who knew they were killing Jews, everything. Knew it. He said the entire community knew it. He says, why didn't you speak out? Well, I didn't want to lose my job. And that's literally what he's saying to me on the pod. And I'm like, oh my God.
But also, and not to not just the Jews. I mean, it started with the way you justify it is vilify on the basis of health risk. I mean, it was disease. It was vermin that allowed people to say, okay, well, this is acceptable. Well, I'll live with this. All right. Well, now it's for my own protection. Sure, it's terrible, but it's for my own protection. And I have no doubt there's others who just said, we didn't know, even though they know they knew, but they cannot admit that they knew.
Yeah, they can't come to terms
because
with it.
Because they caved to their cowardice, or they were faced with their absolute impotence against all of it because they had waited too long and there was nothing more they could do. And that's where the government gets full capture of society. It's when it rewards cowardice and it was cowardice and compliance, and it's for so long that everyone gets absolutely indebted to the government, where they can't even risk anything anymore. They'll lose their job. They'll get tickets that will cripple them financially, and so they just sit home and stay there because they have no option anymore. Because that's how it progresses. Did we get? You know, people always say it's offensive to compare it to, you know, World War II or communism because it didn't result in tens of millions of people dying. Well, now that they started admitting that the jab has, I'm sure it's injured a lot of people, and they got the stickers on the fronts of hospitals now saying vaccinated. Now that we know that it, some of this passivity, some of this compliance has resulted in tens of thousands of lives. I think we can now say it's not the same direction, but it sure as hell was the same. Sorry. It's not the same distance, but it sure as hell was the same direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us had problem with tying COVID to what happened in World War II. I understand. Like, I mean, the force of pushing people into a camp where they just gassed them and moved them on, you know, this, like, yeah, that's a tough comparison to make. But then when you start going back through all the things that were going on in Canada, you're like, come on, folks, we can start to see that we were heading down. We were down like an insane path. And to try and climb out of that now has been, you know, well, Danielle Smith, I mean, you mentioned it. She literally comes out and said they've, you know, the most discriminated people, and then the onslaught of everybody and the apology. And it was like,
But people have to say, first of all, you don't compare apples and oranges, and you don't compare Nazi Germany at its peak or Stalinism at its peak to Canada in 2022. But you could compare it to maybe Germany 1933, compare it to maybe, you know, earlier years in Russia.
1920s.
Again, it doesn't repeat, but it rhymes a little bit. And whether or not it's Stalinism that results in famine that kills 20 million people versus socialism that results in implementing an absolutely wildly unsafe and untested medical procedure that kills tens of thousands of people, it's all right. It doesn't repeat. It rhymes, and we're not the same distance, but we're in the same direction.
It's Solzhenitsyn who talks about what he would have done different if he could have talked to his younger self, and I'm butchering this just a smidge, but he said we would have screamed at the top of our lungs because all of us went willingly. You know, they pulled people, and they just went, oh, yeah, this isn't a big deal. And then, you know, and like, look at what happened in the gulags and everything, right? And look at what happened across all these drugs. People just went along. Jordan Peterson talking about compelled speech when he was talking about it is like, the heck is this guy yelling about? Now we're all like,
now we've got precedent. You got the decision out of British Columbia, two of them. But also people say, well, we don't have camps and we don't have ghettos. It was like, I'm sorry. Again, not repeating, but rhyming. You had designated government designated quarantine facilities. I mean, what the hell is that? You had unchecked,
it's just a place to keep you safe, Viva, from everything and spreading it. It's what's the big deal?
No due process detention in federal facilities. But they didn't kill them. All right, good. They didn't kill them, but that you detained people against their will without telling them where they were going, without giving them the benefit of counsel in government designated quarantine facilities. All right, you're right. That's not identical. It's just mildly rhyming. Now what do we do from here, Sean? This is the question. You have people saying like, I don't, you know, complaining is one thing. You can't comply your way out of tyranny. A lot of people feel that way. And I say, you're right. You can't. But what you can do, scream like hell and mock them mercilessly. And I made a joke the other day, like, you know, Viva has entered the angry Viva stage of the simulation. You know, I spent a few years. I'm still polite and I'm still nice and I know who I am. As far as conveying a message, I try to remain neutral. You know, don't share your opinion. Politics ruins everything. Never discuss religion or politics at a party. On the one hand, I quickly realized that you're going to piss people off and make enemies by remaining neutral and not sharing what you actually believe to begin with. So you're going to make enemies one way or the other. The best thing to do is make the enemies the right way, being true to yourself and by telling the truth. And if you make those enemies, well, then I'll go to, who was it, Winston Churchill or Theodore Roosevelt. I'll judge myself by the enemies that I've made. I'd rather make enemies with the MSM propagandists than make enemies with the good, peace-loving, freedom-loving people because I didn't defend them when they were being oppressed by their government.
Yeah, you said it like, I just want to be like, yeah, high five, you know, amen to that. Like, speak the truth, stick to true to yourself, and at the end of the day, if you can go to bed with a clear conscience, you know, no matter all the insanity that comes at every step you take, so be it. I mean, like, just so be it.
And if it means occasionally telling a journalist on Twitter to go fuck themselves. I'm sorry. If I, even if I feel a little guilty, I've succumbed to my more base desires. I'm going to tell a journalist to go fuck themselves when they sit there lying to everybody, derelicts at their, what is it? Dereliction of their duties as journalists so they can demonize good, peace-loving Canadians. I'll swear every now and again, but I'll try not to make it a bad habit.
Well, I've appreciated you coming on here and doing this with me. I am going to steal a few moments of his time, folks, for Patreon that way. If you want to, if you want to come listen to a couple questions on there. But I appreciate, Vivi, you giving me some time and doing this. This has been a ton of fun.
Thank you very much. And let's tease it out for the Patreon. Ask me about my testicular torsion when we get to Patreon, John.
There you go, folks. His testicular torsion.
Okay. Very painful. Very painful stuff, everybody.
Thanks, Viva.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for tuning in today, guys. I hope you enjoyed it. Today's episode has been brought to you by Calrock Industries. With new, used, and refurbished oil and gas equipment in stock, Calrock is your best bet when it comes to finding equipment that fits your needs, is within your budget, and is ready as soon as you need it. They can even custom manufacture tanks and other equipment for your specific application. They're located here in Lloydminster, but I'm sure they can serve you wherever you are at. All you got to do is go to calrock.ca for more information. I also want to remind people that Patreon, just started posting back on it. We're going to give her a go here for the next 6 months. So if you want to go down in the show notes, you can click on that. Feel free to support. Don't support. It's behind a paywall. So the money is coming back to the podcast. And we got a little behind the scenes action happening there. So love to see and hear your guys' comments on that. Either way, we'll catch up to you on the next episode.